Good morning, everyone. You're listening to the World Teacher Program for Share International New Zealand on Planet FM 104.6. Each Friday morning, we bring you information from the teachers of the Ageless Wisdom. The purpose of our program is to introduce Maitreya, the world teacher for the Age of Aquarius. Maitreya does not come alone. He brings with him the Masters of Wisdom, a group of highly evolved teachers. They work in many fields and can teach us the art of living, how to live in right relationship with each other. With their inspiration, we can transform our civilization, creating justice and peace for us all.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the program. Today I'm going to start with an article that has an environmental theme. It was published in the July-August issue of the magazine, and it's titled Standing Up to Big Oil and Winning. It's not often today that a major corporation is held to account for their misdeeds, wreaking havoc on the environment and human communities. But in January 2021, a court in The Hague delivered a long-awaited landmark verdict, ruling that a subsidiary of Shell is liable for damages caused by a devastating oil spill in October 2004 that destroyed the land, water, and livelihoods of thousands of residents of the Niger Delta. For decades, Africa's Niger Delta, a region rich in oil reserves, has suffered from devastating pollution and human rights violations. Since 1956, when Shell first discovered oil there, international oil conglomerates have been pumping for profits, making Nigeria Africa's largest oil-producing country, with more than 36 billion barrels of proven oil reserves. Every day, about 1.5 million barrels of oil are pumped from the ground in this region. Due to notoriously lax regulations and rampant corruption in the industry, infrastructure, such as pipelines, has not been adequately maintained. This has led to thousands of oil spills in the Niger Delta, destroying the rich ecosystems of this fertile area and devastating dozens of communities. Since 2011, Shell's operations have publicly reported spills amounting to 17.5 million litres of oil leaking into the land and waterways, at times spawning devastating fires. The local communities of this region have, for generations, depended on farming and fishing as their sole livelihoods. Since the spills began, hundreds of thousands of the area's residents have been displaced and disenfranchised, while poverty, violence, and crime have risen sharply. In October of 2004, a pipeline leak was discovered just outside the village of Goi. Rather than accept responsibility for its aging infrastructure, Shell, the pipeline's operator, suggested vandalism was the cause. By the time government agencies began cleanup efforts 2 years later, resident Eric Du says in an article for The Guardian, "We were eating, drinking, breathing the oil." By 2010, the Nigerian government ordered Goi's residents to permanently abandon their town as it was too polluted to recover. By then, most of the village's residents had already left. The destruction had cost Du and his family everything: their home, successful chicken farm, fish ponds, and bakery. In a short span of time, other villages in the region suffered the same fate. To environmental and human rights lawyer Chima Williams, who is also the executive director of the non-governmental organisation Friends of the Earth Nigeria, the pattern seems evident. To investigate, He travelled to more than 20 villages in the region, speaking to the farmers and fishermen whose lives had been upended by the toxic spills and Shell's lack of accountability. Meeting Eric Du and his father, Bariza Du, he believed he had a strong legal argument and, with the support of a handful of other locals' stories, he built four separate cases against Shell. On 9 May 2008, lawyers hired by Friends of the Earth Nigeria and its Dutch sister organisation, Milieu Défense, launched an unprecedented lawsuit against Royal Dutch Shell and SPDC in the Netherlands. The case was widely publicised, as there had never been a case where a European court was asked to address corporate liability wherein the plaintiffs were foreign and the incidents in question had taken place overseas. Eric Du, who became the lead plaintiff after his father became ill, explained that before he was to deliver his testimony, he was gripped by fear. He had never travelled by air, and as he says, let alone talked in the midst of white people who will be questioning you. Battling a multinational corporation with unlimited financial and legal resources was only part of the challenge for these plaintiffs. Even more frightening was the risk of arrest and reprisal in their own country. The Nigerian government and its security forces had long taken the side of the oil companies and had responded to protests and uprisings with violence. Over a decade before, Nigeria hung nine environmental activists, dubbed the Ogoni Nine, who had spoken out against Shell's toxic legacy. While the lawsuit dragged on for nearly 13 years, environmental and human rights groups celebrated the verdict, indicating that this historic ruling paves the way for victims of oil pollution all over the world to pursue justice and compensation from such companies. After the judgment was announced, Williams told the press, "A global standard has been set that the oil companies will not only be held responsible for the destruction they cause to any of their host communities, but will also be reprimanded and held to take steps not to further destroy the environment and source of livelihoods of citizens." More than a year later, in February 2021, the UK's Supreme Court has given the nod to hear cases by two more communities of the Niger Delta, called Ogali and Bili, also suing Royal Dutch Shell and its subsidiary for the widespread environmental impacts of the operations. But justice is slow. After more than a decade of stalling since the Nigerian Supreme Court handed down its decision, Shell has finally agreed to pay the Ijama Ibubu people damages to the tune of $111 million, this is US dollars, to compensate for the pollution its oil operations created in the 1970s. Even after their victory, the legal teams of Eric Du's lawsuit are still, a year later, negotiating a compensation package for the plaintiffs. And The Guardian reports one of Du's attorneys, Channa Samkalden, said, "It feels very inappropriate to claim a victory like that, knowing that we left our clients without any relief until this very day. The real difference needs to be that relief for victims of environmental abuses, human rights abuses abroad, can be obtained within, if not weeks or months, at least within a couple of years, but not like here, 15 years or so. It is kind of ridiculous." At the same time, the oil industry and its supporters in Nigeria are still pushing to maintain its profitability with the passage of a new law that attempts to downplay the risks of the Nigerian oil market. Commenting, Du says, "It is the global community that is advocating for green energy. Now you are inviting the world to this environment again for bigger industry for oil production. Is this part of the world the dumping ground? Are We Not Human Beings? That article was originally sourced from The Guardian in the UK, and I imagine it would also be available on their website. The next article, also from the July-August issue of Share International magazine, is on a very different theme, a spiritual theme. Although actually it covers various themes, it is about letters that Benjamin Creme wrote and the response he obtained. Looking at the issues of the time, this is back in 1975, from a spiritual perspective. It's titled The Varied Work of a Modern Disciple. The following correspondence with a member of the Parliamentary Group for World Government provides a fascinating insight into how Benjamin Creme approached various groups and organisations as he started his public work, creating opportunities to build bridges with them and to convey Maitreya's priorities for a just new world. And this first letter that he wrote to the Parliamentary Group for World Government was written in June 1975 from London. Dear Mr. A, I read with interest the leaflet titled The Case for World Government. To my mind, the crucial problems facing the world today are economic. The distribution of the world's food, raw materials and energy sources to meet the needs of all. No world government or federation is possible until these first steps have been taken, and no peace can be assured until the economic needs of all peoples are served on a just basis. There is no other course open to us, and very little time left before millions of people in the underdeveloped countries face starvation and disease on an unprecedented scale. The education of people towards a sense of this global responsibility is the first priority. It seems to me that the overwhelming necessity at the present time is to present to the nations and governments of the world not a complete blueprint for a world government structure, but some basic principles which would be the minimum requirements for a new world order. To my mind, these could be summarised roughly as follows. Firstly, the recognition that there is one humanity. Secondly, the recognition that the principle of sharing in economic affairs is the only way out of man's present dilemma and must be implemented on a world scale by some United Nations economic organisation representing all nations, developed and undeveloped. Thirdly, the necessity of a state of peace to enable all nations to develop the well-being of their peoples. And fourthly, the necessity of all nations to recognise their mutual dependence in the fields of finance, economics, and scientific and technological discovery. Were these few basic principles to be presented with sufficient effort and conviction and on a worldwide scale, the peoples of the world would be enabled to see their fundamental practicality and sound sense, and it would not be long before the necessary structures were erected to implement them, thus automatically bringing about a world federation of nations based on mutual dependence and economic justice. And that was signed off, yours sincerely, Benjamin Creme. He received a response in September of the same year from the Parliamentary Group for World Government, and it goes as follows. Dear Mr. Creme, thank you for your letter. We seem to be in substantial agreement. The difficulty lies in the human race having, as its spokesmen, national governments, which can only express a sectional point of view vis-a-vis humanity. So they will sign almost anything and do nothing. Unfortunately, people not in government, with the exception of organised labour, have little influence as yet. The main task, as we see it, is to create a mouthpiece for the general interest, something much more effective than the UN Secretary General. We would then hope that the mouthpiece would utter the kind of principles you have outlined, and they would be acted upon. The mouthpiece seems to some of us most unlikely to emanate from government. Historically, such people have emerged from priesthoods of one kind or another. Certainly, the spokesmen for mankind should not be representatives of particular bits of territory. If you have ideas on this problem of representation, I hope you will let me know. Thank you again for your interest and constructive suggestions. Yours sincerely, P.A. And here is Mr. Krem's response, which was sent the same month, September 1975. Dear Mr. A, thank you for your most interesting letter. I entirely agree that it is not to governments that we may look for the kind of representatives which we both envisage, with a broad inclusiveness of vision transcending national boundaries and interests. Such spokesmen do exist. They are not yet in a position to enter the international arena, but we may look for their emergence in the near future. To make their emergence possible and their action fruitful, it is in the first place necessary for all men of goodwill and all men with the interests of the one humanity at heart to erect a platform from which these spokesmen can work and can inspire the peoples of the world. This platform must have as its base the principles of cooperation and sharing for the good of all, which I outlined in my previous letter and on which we seem to be agreed. How can this platform be built? It is necessary that over the next 1 or 2 years, as many groups and agencies as can be mobilized throughout the world should take their stand on and make known their acceptance of these basic principles. They should base all their propaganda on these few desirable aims and quickly establish them as the normal, practical, and only solution to our problems. This is a very difficult, but not, I think, impossible task, if tackled with energy and conviction. There are enough men and women in all countries now in positions of influence and relative power who accept these principles and wish to see them implemented. They could now make contact with each other through the groups and agencies to which they belong and give aid and support to each other in a worldwide declaration of their belief that therein lies the solution. The large majority of humanity would quickly respond to such a lead and contribute their voice and aspiration for a better, more just life. Nothing, no government, could for long withstand the united voice of such an informed public opinion. Then those who are waiting for just such a time can emerge and coordinate and guide the efforts towards fusion and justice. The problem of power and influence to implement such principles is more apparent than real. My own view is that there exist, precisely in the world trade union movement, men of vision and broad humanity who are ideally placed to propagate these ideas and aims, if correctly approached, not in their capacity as sectional leaders, but as representing the increasingly articulate masses of ordinary people throughout the world. They also wield, albeit not always constructively, real power. Given a lead by such groups as yourselves, they could accomplish much. I was most interested in your view that the mouthpiece seems to some of us most unlikely to emanate from government. Historically, such people have emerged from priesthoods of one kind or another. Certainly, the spokesmen for mankind should not be representatives of particular bits of territory. To this comment, I entirely agree. Events have a way of proving the continuity of purpose in history. Yours sincerely, Benjamin Krem. And that was the series of letters. Thank you very much for listening to the program today. And if you'd like further information, check out the website share-international.org or email us at sharenz@yahoo.com. And wishing you all a lovely week.